This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodl Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
Today I'm interviewing Professor Philip Podsiadlowski from Oxford University, who's been giving us a colloquium here at Jodl Bank on the diversity of different types of supernova explosions. So my sort of naive idea of a supernova is that you have a very massive star, it's fusing various types of material sequentially, you end up with iron. You can't get any more energy out of the fusion, and then without a heat source, the whole star collapses, and there's a great explosion, and that's a supernova. But you've been telling us that it's not quite as simple as that.
That is one of the main supernova types. As you said correctly, a massive star that has burned everything to iron can no longer produce any energy and has to collapse. And the collapse then produces either a neutron star or a black hole. However, that itself doesn't produce a supernova yet, because the supernova is actually the explosion of the envelope. Nova stands for new star, and supernova, a bright new star that all of a sudden appears, but it's really the envelope.
So the envelope of the star is the surrounding atmosphere?
Well, it's actually the bulk of the star, typically. The iron core is maybe 1.5 solar masses, but the total mass of the star may be 10, 20 solar masses. So it's really most of the star that is ejected in the supernova. The big question, however, is how do you get something that implodes, forming this neutron star or black hole, actually cause an explosion of the envelope? And there's a lot of energy that's released in this implosion, but most of that energy comes out in the form of neutrinos. These neutrinos couple weakly to matter, and therefore it's not clear how a fraction of that energy can be deposited in the envelope. And to date, there are no realistic calculations that show that you get an explosion.
So we have a lot of these sort of ghostly particles, which are the neutrinos.
Yes.
And normally they just pass right through ordinary matter, but...
Now, we know that some supernovae do exactly this, because there is supernova 1987A that occurred 24 years ago, and the neutrinos from that supernova, a few of the neutrinos, were actually observed, and total of 17.
17 neutrinos, well, that was quite... a lot compared to the usual background, I suppose.
Yes, oh yes, that's way above the background. And even though it was only 17 neutrinos, it was enough to actually determine the total energy that must have been in the neutrinos. And that's comparable to the energy that's released when you form a neutron star. So we know, in fact, in that particular case, that a neutron star formed initially, even though it has not yet been detected.
Okay, so left over from that explosion, there's a very dense core. Could it at some point appear as a pulsar?
Well, definitely. People have been looking for a pulsar in that supernova remnant ever since. And there have been several claims of a pulsar having been detected, but they were all turned out to be incorrect.
So was that supernova in 1987 a sort of classical supernova as we might expect to see it?
No, it wasn't. In fact, it was a very different star that exploded than what was expected. I mean, you expect stars to become big red supergiants like Betelgeuse and to explode in that phase. Now, this one was actually a blue supergiant, and it didn't look very evolved. I mean, this has been a big puzzle. I think the explanation for that is that it used to be two stars that merged.
Right.
And that changed the structure sufficiently that a star that is red initially then becomes blue.
So it was kind of masquerading as a younger star.
It was then masquerading as a much younger object. And we know that something dramatic happened, because there is a complex nebula consisting of three rings surrounding it, and that these ejecta must have something to do with what happened 20,000 years ago with this merging event.
So those multiple rings could be to do with the fact there was more than one body initially there.
Yes, I mean, you would never expect a single star to eject matter in such a funny way.
Mm. So. And is it something that we can model at the moment?
Well, yes. In fact, I had a PhD student who modeled this, and it was published on the 20th anniversary of the supernova, on the 23rd of February in 2007. But that's just the one type of supernova. Classically, there are two main types. There are these core collapse supernovae that occur in massive stars. But there's a second type of supernova, so-called thermonuclear explosion, which occurs in a white dwarf, in a carbon-oxygen white dwarf. When its mass gets close to the critical mass, the Chandrasekhar mass, it ignites carbon under degenerate conditions, and that leads to a thermonuclear runaway. As a result of the thermonuclear runaway, the whole star is completely disrupted.
So perhaps you should explain a little bit about what the white dwarf is. That's left over from something that's less massive than the sort of star that creates a supernova.
That's less massive than a star that produces a Korkolep supernova.
Ah, okay, yes.
The initial mass would be less than 7 solar masses. Probably not much less. Because one of the big puzzles there is, why does the white dwarf mass grow? And that's the big puzzle for this particular supernova type. One idea is that you accrete matter from a companion star till it gets to the critical mass. Or the other idea is that you have actually two white dwarfs that merge and produce a single more massive object. Both of these models have their pros and cons, and there's a big debate going on at the moment.
So they just reach a mass where the white dwarf can no longer exist in that state, and then it becomes even more dense.
Right. It ignites carbon when it's quite close to the Chandrasekhar mass.
So it's something like 1.4
it's solar 1.
Masses.
Yes, 1.38 or something. Yeah. Now, these are interesting from a cosmological point of view, because these have been used as standard candles, and these provided the first evidence that the universe is not just expanding, but that it may actually be accelerating.
So what do we mean by a standard candle?
Well, a standard candle means that you have an object whose intrinsic luminosity, you know. If you measure the flux and then use one of our squared law, then you can deduce the distance. Now, these are actually not very good standard candles, but there seems to be a way of making them standard candles, because the brighter ones decay more slowly than the fainter ones. And so you can correct for differences in luminosity that way. But that's done mainly empirically, I should say.
Okay, so you're actually looking at the brightness of the phenomenon over a period of time and using that to say how bright it is.
That's right. I mean, the different types of supernovae are bright for different amounts of times. These Korkolep supernovae, classical, tend to be bright for hundreds of days. Thermonuclear explosions tend to be bright for a much shorter amount of time. So it's typically the first 30 days which you need to measure the light curve.
And if we looking at cosmic expansion from this, presumably some of these events that we're seeing are redshifted significantly and therefore very, very far away.
Yes.
So there's obviously a huge amount of energy coming out of these kind of explosions.
Right. Certainly you can see these thermonuclear explosions to redshifts of about 1.5. In fact, I think the record now is about 2 and a little bit. But there's another supernova type which you can observe at even larger distances, and these are related to gamma-ray bursts. In fact, the gamma-ray bursts can be seen at very high redshifts. The record holder at the moment is a redshift of 9.4.
So that's looking back at very significant fraction of the age of the universe.
Yes, the universe was about 500 million years old at that time. So at the moment, I think that's the most distant, well-established object in the universe. The reason is they are not only bright, but the energy, the gamma rays, are relativistically beamed. So that amplifies the flux you receive if you are in the beam.
So they're not just exploding in all directions?
No. If they were doing that, then you would not be able to see them at such high redshifts.
Okay. I have a bit of a question related to that, actually. One of the things that you talked about was how the metallicity of a star affects the supernova explosion that happens.
Yes.
So in this very early supernova, in the early universe, presumably that came from a star which had very low metallicity. Can you see anything in the signature of that that gives away that it's happening in the young universe?
We don't quite know what the progenitors of gamma-ray bursts are. In one of the models, it has to do with the metallicity. And the problem is, we think that in order to get a gamma-ray burst, you need a rapidly rotating star, and actually a rapidly rotating core of a star that collapses. Now, at solar metallicity, massive stars lose all of their rotation because of stellar winds. And so we don't think that single stars would be rapidly rotating when they explode. But if you go to low metallicity, then the winds become much weaker, and you may end up with a rapidly rotating core. This particular model then predicts that there should be many more gamma ray bursts at higher redshifts. And you should see that if you look at the redshift distribution of gamma ray bursts, you should see that the number of gamma ray bursts relative to the supernovae should go up. Since we can observe gamma rays basically at all redshifts, that can already be tested. And that doesn't seem to be the case.
Really, so there doesn't seem to be a difference in what supernovae were like in the past, particularly.
It's not obvious that the gamma ray burst rate goes up as you would expect in that model.
Right. Do we have any idea why that is, or is that just still a mystery?
This is just one particular model. There are other ways of getting rapidly rotating stars, and that's if you have binary systems, because then you have a lot of angular momentum, and there are various ideas that you might produce a gamma ray burst if you have two cores of a star merge, because then you always end up with a rapidly rotating core. And that's not so metallicity dependent. In fact, now I've mentioned binaries twice, the binary evolution, I think, is one of the main factors for the diversity of supernovae, observed supernovae.
So a lot of stars actually have companions and exist.
Well, in particular, if you look at massive stars, the most massive stars actually all seem to be close binaries. Not only that, they tend to have masses that are quite comparable. So if one star is massive, the companion star tends to have a similar mass.
And what's then the effect on a supernova when it happens if there's a companion present?
Well, if the companion is still present, then certainly part of the envelope of that companion will be stripped off, which you may see in the ejector. It also can affect the supernova remnant itself.
The shape? And
the shape, yes.
As in the case of 1987A, I guess.
Well, at the time of the explosion, there was no companion star left, right? So the idea there was that the two stars merged completely and produced a single star.
Ah, and that star then survived for some amount of time
that
before...
That survived for the next 20,000 years and then...
Okay. So there's quite a zoo of different phenomena.
Yes, and one of the big questions also that's not solved is when do you form a neutron star and when do you form a black hole? And when you form a black hole, you don't necessarily expect a bright supernova, because if everything collapses, then nothing has to come out.
Right.
So black hole-forming supernovae may be rather faint, and... The way to how you would detect them is you had a massive star disappear.
Right, sort of swallowed up by its own core, really.
Yes. I mean, that's possible in principle, but you need to observe, look at lots of stars and have a record, and then you can go back, let's say, 10 years later and see whether they are still all there.
So what I wanted to ask about the observational side of supernovae is can we... clearly distinguish these different types of supernovae that we're expecting, or is the empirical side of studying supernovae a little bit different in terms of classification?
Yes, it's actually very difficult to relate the theoretical phenomena that happen in the cores of these stars to the observations. In the case of supernova 1987A, it was possible because the neutrinos were actually observed. Mm-hmm. Now, that's the only supernova where that has been possible.
Close.
Because it was very close, it was in the Large Magellanic Cloud, so it's nearby. On the other hand, what you observe, is a spectrum and a light curve, and that doesn't tell you anything about what happens in the core. So you need a lot of theoretical modeling to determine, for example, the mass in the ejector. I mean, that's certainly helpful. But if you have a star that has lost all of its hydrogen, because of binary interactions, for example, then it produces a type 1 supernova that looks very similar to a thermonuclear explosion. And it does happen occasionally that they are being confused.
So we can't be quite sure when we see a supernova necessarily the mechanism that's caused it.
No. It's probably not so difficult for the thermonuclear explosions because they produce a lot of silicon and sulfur in the explosion, which you can see, and that's a good indicator. But now that thousands of supernovae are discovered every year, there are more and more new types where it's not clear whether you have a core collapse supernova or some thermonuclear explosion.
Okay. So I should probably explain that the light curve is what you were talking about before, the brightness as a function of time.
That's right.
And the spectrum is telling us what chemicals or what elements are present
in the ejector and the elements you see at a particular time.
So with now, as you're saying, seeing thousands of supernovae per year, How are we observing them nowadays, and how does that compare with, observations 20 years ago?
Well, until a few years ago, most supernovae were discovered by amateurs. And that's just because they were covering a bigger part of the sky every night. Now, there are systematic surveys, transient surveys, and they are now finding more supernovae than the amateurs. There are several transient surveys happening right now or starting in the near future. And this will just add more to the complexity.
Yes.
Because we have no good criteria to identify the particular mechanisms. And so it's actually quite a mess at the moment.
You have a good collection of data to,
yes,
to study.
Well, you actually have too much data too. Because many of these, to really get useful information, you don't just need the light curve. You need to look to get spectra, and you need to get spectra at different times. And that's very time-consuming. It requires a lot of also telescope time. And what you really need are dedicated telescopes that follow up all of them. See, at the moment, what happens, only about 10% of these supernovae are being followed up. And that introduces interesting human selection effects.
Right.
Because the ones that are being followed up are the ones someone decided to be most interesting.
I see, yeah.
And so that's rather bad for getting good statistics on supernovae. I mean, we don't know the statistics of the different types of supernovae very well. I mean, there is one core collapse supernova in our galaxy roughly every 100 years, and wow, a thermonuclear explosion every 300 years. And the gamma ray burst perhaps every 100,000 years.
Good grief. So we really don't expect to see ones in the local neighborhood very often.
No.
Or perhaps should be glad about that in the case of gamma ray bursts.
Yes. Well, if they are too close, they could be rather destructive. People have estimated that if they are too close, they could cause mass extinctions. But the universe is big, and so there's a supernova occurring in the universe every few seconds. And that probably a few hundred gamma ray bursts in the universe per day.
So as someone that studies pulsars, there was a link that you mentioned between a type of supernova called electron capture and the production of a particular pulsar. So I was interested in that, and I was wondering if you could explain what we think happens in an electron capture supernova.
Yes, I mean, at the beginning we talked about iron core collapse supernovae, where the core collapses because you have an iron core. But for stars that have a mass around 10 solar masses, something happens already before you form an iron core. You have hydrogen, helium, and carbon burning, but that produces an oxygen, neon, magnesium core. And when that reaches a certain critical density, you get electron captures. What it means is the electrons combine with magnesium nuclei, magnesium and neon. These cores are supported by electron degeneracy, which means the electrons provide the pressure support. If you capture them onto magnesium, that pressure support disappears. And so all of a sudden, the core loses its hydrostatic support and collapses.
So it sounds a little bit like the process in which a neutron star is formed.
That happens when you form a neutron star as well, but it doesn't cause the collapse there. I mean, it's true in the collapse of an iron core, the protons actually do merge with the electrons.
Okay.
So it is a similar effect.
Okay.
And it also, it helps to destabilize the formation of a neutron star as well. But it's not the cause there.
Okay. So when the electrons are captured and it collapses, what's the result of a supernova like that?
Now, there are several differences compared to normal supernovae. First, this occurs at a very characteristic density, which means it occurs for a certain mass of the collapsing object, which is 1.375. We can calculate that. Now, the resulting neutron star will then be slightly less massive because a lot of the gravitational binding energy is released, and it produces a very specific mass, and that mass is 1.25 solar masses. And so it produces a subclass of neutron stars with that precise mass.
Which is quite a low mass.
Which is quite a low mass. But there are now about 4 neutron stars known that are more or less exactly at that mass. So that's the first thing. The second thing is the supernova itself is most likely much fainter because these have very fluffy envelopes, which are very easy to eject. and then the energy in the supernova is always of the order of the binding energy of the envelope. So they will be fainter, and they will probably be also have fewer instabilities in the collapse process. And it's these instabilities in the collapse that are believed to produce what's called a neutron star kick. I mean, most single pulses are observed to have high space velocities, which are associated with the asymmetry in the supernova. So the typical velocity is a few hundred kilometers per second. Mm. Now, you don't expect that for these electron capture supernovae, because these instabilities that probably cause these kicks cannot operate.
Okay, and I think you were saying that was because final collapse happens rather quickly in these
That's
cases.
Right. I mean, these instabilities I'm talking about, they occur on a characteristic timescale, and that timescale is tens of milliseconds. The collapse has to occur on a timescale that's at least 5 or 10 of these timescales, so that the instability can grow enough. And if you don't have the time, then you don't get a big kick.
So that final collapse in any supernova really is a very, very fast process compared to, obviously, the lifetime and even the post-main sequence phase of the star. The supernovas happens phenomenally quickly.
Certainly the phase where you form the compact object and trigger the supernova, that is over in less than a second.
Right.
However, that's actually still a long time scale, because the natural time scale of a neutron star is milliseconds. So that's the dynamical time scale of a neutron star. So the whole process has to be prolonged over 1,000 dynamical times.
Right.
Which is actually not that easy.
Okay.
So even though it sounds short, it isn't.
Well, then perhaps as a last question, obviously the observations of supernovae are really forging ahead now. So in the future, do you see the theoretical modelling of supernovae catching up, or is that going to take some time to sort of sort out the picture of what's going on?
I think it will take some time. And the problem really is that you only have very limited observations. I mean, if you could always look at some signature of what happens at the center, then it would be easy at least to identify the mechanism, the explosion mechanism. But a lot of the diversity comes from different envelope properties or just different environments. And some of that is just like weather.
Okay.
And you need to be able to look through that weather to really get to the understanding of what really goes on. The calculations, some of these supernova calculations, are still very unreliable. There's no fully self-consistent calculation that shows how a massive star collapses and produces a supernova. And these calculations are done on big supercomputers, and they take about a year.
Right.
So that means it takes a long time just to really to explore the relevant physics. So that we are really relying on indirect arguments, like, for example, looking at pulsars or pulsars in binaries that tell us a lot. I mean, the binary pulsar itself, the second pulsar in that system, is probably one of these electron capture supernovae. And it has the right mass of 1.25 solar masses, and it's very clear that that supernova did not produce a large kick. So that is one way of corroborating these ideas with observations. It's a type of archaeology. It's not based on first principle calculations because they are still too difficult.
Oh, very interesting. Thank you very much for being interviewed.
You're welcome.